What is up, guys? This is Rain Charger for Living Indigenous Media. I have another episode for you here again today. This episode is with Dr. Joshua Miner of the KU Film and Media Studies Department. And we had a little sit down talking about video games and their kind of space that they occupy in the Indigenous life. We talked a little bit about video game creators and, you know, a big theme of this podcast and this project in general is talking about potentiality and directions that these medias will take. And I think it's an important bridge to cross when we're talking about newish kinds of platforms. You know, the video game perspective is not a really old one. So, you know, the Indigenous component of that has a lot of potential, I think. And really, Dr. Miner, he's got a, in my opinion, he's got a really nice pulse on where that's going. I think he's going to be keeping a watchful eye on the Indigenous video game industry as that's burgeoning. So please, please enjoy this episode of Living Indigenous Media. Again, you can hit me at my contact. You can get at me through my KU email address at raincharger@ku.edu. Whatever platform you're listening to this on, there ought to be a link to it. If not, you can check it out at anchor.com, which is where I am holding this podcast. Again, thank you so much for listening.
Okay, I'm here with Dr. Joshua Miner, and this is Living Indigenous Media, the podcast talking about Indigenous media movements from a scholarly and kind of casual level. Dr. Miner, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you're here at KU in the Film and Media Studies Department. I guess I want to start with kind of like your history in the Film and Media Studies area. So before we get into kind of the discussion of video gaming.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm actually fairly fairly new to Film and Media Studies. As far as, you know, the kinds of work that I teach here, mm-hmm. You know, through over the past decade or so, I've been teaching mostly Indigenous film and video game studies, and that sort of coalesced as I came on, and I guess 2015 here at KU.
Okay, I didn't know that you had such a background in Indigenous film, actually.
Yeah.
Like we were talking about, I had a really good discussion with Dr. Anderson about that. Maybe later on in the summer we can have a little more in-depth conversation on the film side of things.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess let's start with kind of video games as a medium. I've been a pretty avid gamer most of my life, at least on some capacity, a lot less now that I'm in college. I think we've seen kind of this big cultural shift in the way people view and look at video games rather mm-hmm. than just as a source of entertainment. I think we're seeing these realms of kind of like art and social critique. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of a roundabout way that we... I think broadly in the United States arrived at that
right.
At that view of games. I think in part really because of the scare in the 90s about the relationship between violence, specifically violence in young men who were gamers, mm-hmm. and just the violent rhetoric that gets circulated through game communities and video game form. And I think as time's gone on, that link, while the scare, of course, was overhyped, and has been more complicated, I think there is some value into understanding the way that games shape our understanding of how we should interact with each other, mm-hmm. our understanding of how we interact with our environments, and especially experimental game designers and Indigenous game designers, right, have really run with that,
right.
I think, over the past, you know, 5 years especially. So,
yeah, I think, you know, more and more we're seeing these narratives that aren't just like your run and gun or your action adventure. They're kind of deeper or more vague sometimes.
Uh-huh.
Not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but the whole Never Alone game
mm-hmm.
From out of those
Upper
are our
One
last,
games.
Yes.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I mean, it's just an insane visual style, and it's a very different narrative than most video games even today. I guess let's go back a little bit. So you teach a Native American video gaming class here on campus?
I teach a broad Indigenous film and media class,
okay.
in which we engage with Indigenous game design, but in my video game production class, which I'm teaching this semester, we sort of throughout the semester, we will look at experimental games from lots of different areas, including indigenous game designers.
So. Okay. With that, do you have like a small history or contextualization of kind of like where natives have sat in the video game production realms?
You know, rather than looking at it historically, I think it's, you know, one thing that's helped me is to understand the interventions that indigenous game designers have made mm-hmm. through different routes. So on the one hand, a game like Never Alone emerges from, you know, frankly, a slightly larger pot of funding that comes through a partnership, right, with a particular kind of nonprofit organization. And then, you know, sort of on the other side of things, we have experimental game designers working really on their own, or, you know, super women like Elizabeth LePonce, who sort of has her fingers in a lot of different partnerships. But you'll find that a lot of indigenous games that get released end up being released as companion media to television shows, whether mm-hmm. on the Aboriginal People's Television Network in Canada, or with museums. I know Elizabeth did a mini game with, I think, the Duluth Children's Museum last year. So there are a lot of these sort of partnerships with different cultural organizations and nonprofits that I think enable some inroads for that, because it's virtually impossible, given the sort of constraints of a broad audience, of a large game development company to put the kind of funding into a major indigenous game project.
Right. And I know that, you know, in the modern day video game conversation, large AAA titles are kind of like, how do I say this? People are kind of shying away from them on some levels. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are turning towards indie games and going to that back page of Steam.
Absolutely.
You know, do you think that is a realm that natives are going to start exploiting more rather than just being tied to major corporate companies?
I mean, I think you hit it on the spot, right? A lot of it has to do with distribution and ways in which indie designers can get their games out, right? So Steam has been a great resource. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it depends. I mean, and it also depends on what the games are designed for. I think Never Alone was unique. I mean, it has some unique formal features, which are pretty cool. But it also, in many ways, is a very beautifully well-designed but very conventional 2D platformer, mm-hmm. right? I think in a lot of ways, its indigeneity, for lack of a more precise way to put it, is sort of at the surface level, a lot of it, right? The sort of cultural insights notwithstanding. So, and I think that was a major move forward, mm-hmm. right? But a lot of other games that are working in maybe areas of video game development that don't get a lot of critical attention, like educational games, right, have been huge. And a lot of the goals of indigenous filmmakers have ported over to indigenous gaming, right? Language revitalization, right. Cultural expression, and stewardship. I mean, these are all big areas for indigenous game designers. So.
Right. Okay. So I guess, you know, hypothetically, do you see that natives will kind of reach that big intersection of where the representation is not the only thing, as we're kind of it's not the only thing in Never Alone, but it's kind of the primary focus. Do you think we'll start to see indigenous gameplay meeting indigenous representation kind of as the video game itself?
Yeah.
Do you see those realms happening?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a great way to put it, right? Yeah, and that's always a first step, is visibility and representation. I think those are important first steps.
Of course.
And those are the steps, really, that are going to be available to broad audiences, more accessible. So, mm-hmm. But, you know, a lot of what I teach is really looking under the hood at indigenous games and looking for the ways in which they operate on different mechanical structures or different logics of interaction, and really pushing toward a kind of horizon of indigenous computation, mm-hmm. right? What does that look like? What does it mean? And there are a lot of really, really wonderful game and media designers working in game-based media. Up at Concordia, for example, is just one of the ones that I really always come back to with the Initiative for Indigenous Futures, because they're doing such amazing work up there, right? And mm-hmm. really kind of trying to rethink computation from an indigenous perspective.
Okay. Now, with that, I think a lot of people maybe don't realize what goes into making a video game. if we're thinking at it from a tribal perspective, do you think tribes could gain an infrastructure or set up an infrastructure for creation of video games so that maybe they could have some kind of like self-determination through gaming? Do you think that that's another realm that maybe we'll see here in the near future?
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of the games that have come out have come through Purity and Decay started development through Dames Making Games Game Jam. So there are a lot of kind of other all that to say, I think a lot of partnerships that indigenous communities are making with game development among other marginalized communities has been really powerful. But the tools are out there and available, right? I mean, whether you're making text-based games through Twine or you're learning Unity or upping your game with something like Unreal, I mean, there are certainly tools out there for indigenous development groups to get together and start putting games together. So absolutely.
I mean, I'd sure love to see it, you know, video game prepared by the Seminole Nation or something.
Of course, yeah. And I mean, they're already out there. Games sponsored by and mostly put together by individual tribes. It's just the funding for distribution thus far has required these sort of outside partnerships.
I mean, if we're, you know, like we're getting into talks of Unreal, it would be great to see a native version of Quake or something.
Oh, absolutely.
Like that.
Yeah.
My God. So we talked a little bit about representation, but I don't think you can ever kind of, at least where we're at right now, you can't escape the discussion of representation when you talk about these media areas. I know that we've had problematics in video games about native representation. Thinking back on it, TF2 has a cosmetic item that's a headdress. Mortal Kombat has a Nightwolf, who always kind of... I remember being a little kid playing Mortal Kombat, and Nightwolf is this Apache guy who uses energetic tomahawks and bows and arrows but speaks Lakota. Like, you know... What do you think of representation of natives in video games lately, like from the bigger companies?
From the bigger companies? I mean, you know, a lot of the touchstones that people latch onto from, these sort of AAA titles, I think, you know, representation has gotten better. I think the limitations are the limitations of, again, the conventions of the form, right, which the conventions of video games demand that your protagonist attacks and kills enemies, right? That's just, that's the standard for 75% of all video games. And for that reason, that's already setting you up to port in certain kinds of histories that we already know, whether that's from literature or film or just broader cultural narratives. And of course, when you do that, you end up with, of course, who's your antagonist, right? So, I mean, I think that there have been, though, some really interesting ways around that problem. Assassin's Creed did that pretty well, right?
Right.
But again, that's still a colonial perspective, a sympathetic colonial perspective, maybe a more fully dimensional perspective, but still not an indigenous perspective on what it means to have an indigenous protagonist.
Right.
Right, and what indigenous concerns are in that context, that historical context, for example. And again, right, I mean, if you can't just change the color of the protagonist and expect that offers an indigenous perspective, right? Because the systems of interaction are the same.
You still see those parallels in film with video games. You know, the whole discussion of Johnny Depp as the Lone Ranger, or as Tonto.
Right.
You know, you kind of see that similar, just repackaging
absolutely,
of a different hero.
I mean, and the structure of how you build video games encourages that, right? I mean, you just plaster a new texture onto a model, right? Yeah, exactly.
I know that there was a bit of a, not, maybe you can call it a debacle with the new Civ game or the new Civ expansion, and I think they had the Kree. Do you have any thoughts on that? You know, is that,
you know,
incorporation, or is that just kind of assimilation still?
What was it in Civ 6 that had the sort of colonial technology in the tree? What do you remember this?
I'm not a big Civ player, so I just was very aware of the. I read a lot of the discussion about it, but I didn't get too deep into the nuts and bolts of the game itself.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the history of civilization, you find again that their first inroads is in representation, right?
Right.
They give you a. I mean, I think what was it? Is it Sitting Bull that became the first
Right.
Might have been the first sort of native leader. But of course, again, the game is still a colonial game. It's based on colonialism. You've basically put Sitting Bull's face, you know, in a cartoon context, but Sitting Bull's face onto an otherwise colonial empire. And in that case, and I think I mentioned this when we spoke a couple weeks ago, the barbarians in civilization,
right?
Those are the true indigenous people of civilization, no matter whose face you put on a colonial empire. So.
Right. You know, another game we've been looking at in Dr. Warrior's class that I think is really interesting and brings it a whole different intersection up is this Thunderbird Strike, an app-based game. Very accessible. It's free. It's mostly nonviolent. Uh-huh. You know, you're mostly destroying trucks or something. Do you think video games are showing a more big presence in a post-Dapple, post-Standing Rock world? For natives,
Elizabeth LaPonce has been great too about using limited resources to make accessible mobile games that push the boundaries on what kinds of interaction might be available in a video game. And I think Thunderbird Strike, again, I mean, under the hood, it's a relatively conventional side-scrolling platformer, but at the level of semantics, right on the surface.
Right.
Those images and what you're really interacting with, not to mention her specific aesthetics, visual style,
right.
really shapes the way that those mechanics are acted out as you play the game. That game, of course, has extra layers of controversy given both its funding source and the sort of energy lobbyists that attacked it when it was released. So that's a kind of an interesting case. But she's done some other kind of smaller, or I guess I shouldn't say smaller, but more under the radar mobile games. I Was So In is one that came out, I'm trying to remember what year, maybe 2015. And this is kind of a mobile, you might call it like an environmental stewardship game, right?
Right.
Designed to teach certain kinds of ways of interacting with the environment, which mirrors Thunderbird Strike, but maybe is less politically inflected by Standing Rock and the pipeline. So
I guess let's get into art style a bit, you know?
Yeah.
Some that stand out to me is like Okami, the traditional kind of Japanese art style, kind of getting away from the modern day hyper-realistic, again, coming out of the Unreal Engine and different platforms like that. Are we going to see native art styles like in a similar aesthetic to Thunderbird Strike? Do you think that has a popular, will people latch on to that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, and again, much like the visual art world for native painters, especially
right,
working in the early 20th century. When I think about that history and how it mirrors today's history, there are both an accepted sort of mainstream set of artistic conventions, in this case, video game conventions,
right?
And then there are assumptions, and oftentimes a really strict box that gets drawn around about what constitutes a native or indigenous visual aesthetic in a video game.
Right.
I think Elizabeth has done a great job, pushing at the boundaries of what is understood in a mainstream sense to be an indigenous visual art style. And that's one thing I really like about Thunderbird Strike. And then, a lot of the other games that she's done are working against or with other kinds of video game conventions, whether that's, kind of an 8 or 16-bit pixelated style, sort of referential or vintage style, or the educational games that she's done, which, given the fact that they're working in an educational space, are borrowing from a different set of visual aesthetics that are, keyed toward children or, whatever audience. So,
As video games are kind of expounding out further and becoming, I guess, more mainstream, kind of everybody you talk to has Farmville or Candy Crush or some app or something, and
right.
it's outside of outside of these realms of age. Are natives going to be a part of that? Do you think that we can bring I know you aren't enrolled or anything, but you're familiar with native communities. Do you see expanding video games as a narrative to older native people or people who didn't grow up with video games, do you think that, they become more accessible? Do you think that they become more something that people can get in line with or have a dialogue with?
I mean, I think that's why mobile games are so important. Mm-hmm. Web games to a lesser degree, but especially mobile games, in part because they are immediately accessible especially the, you know, when we think about, I don't know, this very long-standing conversation about the, quote, digital divide and what that means, of course, mobile games are going to be the most accessible in that context especially. Mm-hmm. And given that, you know, mobile games are specifically designed to teach you the gameplay quickly and easily as you play the game. So whereas it's very hard to pick up Halo, for example,
right,
which you might think as an FPS game it would just be easy to pick up, but today's FPS games, especially those on console, are really complicated to play, and they're really not accessible for audiences that aren't, you know, that wouldn't consider themselves gamers. Mobile games, on the other hand, very accessible, and specifically in their gameplay. If you pick up Thunderbird Strike, it takes you 45 seconds to learn how to play that game, and right. I think that's wonderful, right? I mean, in some ways, it's limiting for those who are really experienced and talented with video gameplay, but in another sense, I think they're more inviting for a broader audience. And that's exactly the place you want social impact video games.
Right.
Right. You want to reach a broad audience. You want to communicate something in particular about the relationship between, you know, the Dakota Access Pipeline and the land. Right in the Dakotas, you can do that through a mobile game, right, that has really stripped down gameplay.
Right. So. You know, I don't think you separate, as we've talked about, you don't separate the social conversation away from video games anymore. You look at other things people have created, and you see stuff like Gamergate, mm-hmm. and these areas of, like, you might call it toxic masculinity, you might call it just toxicity in general about some of these cultures that grow up around certain video games. I used to play League of Legends a lot, uh-huh. and I mean, the fan base is just kind of ridiculous sometimes. Yeah. So with that, are natives creating kind of the pushback or maybe safer areas for people to have these discussions about video games or to have these kind of social commentaries happening or not have toxic areas of discussion, I guess?
You know, it's, I oftentimes am a little bit conflicted about visibility, mm-hmm. and sort of broader, reaching broader audiences, inviting broader audiences in for conversations, in part because what that requires is connecting on the level of, you know, mainstream understandings of what your particular culture or people are like, right? And so that requires, you know, in order to have, for example, a broad audience film about indigenous experience, even a very, say, something like Wind River, right? It requires certain kinds of, I don't really like the simplicity of this concept, but it requires certain stereotypes in order to speak at that broad level, mm-hmm. right? In as much as it's having a very important conversation. And I think video games can operate in the same way, right?
Right.
And we see that in the Assassin's Creed a game in particular, where it relies on certain sort of base understandings, and in fact, mostly misconceptions about the role, the political roles that Native people, you know, had at that time, right. to, you know, colonial governments. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a complicated space, right? And I would like to see those conversations be more open and welcoming and reaching broader audiences in particular. But again, that always requires this sort of like double-sided approach of speaking at the broad audience level and really pushing for a more nuanced understanding of what indigenous cultures are like.
Right. You know? I've often felt that, you know, video games as a creative space, especially in terms of social commentary and representation, are really not priority for a lot of people.
Right.
You know, the mascot issue is still hotly debated. You talk about film still, and even books, mm-hmm. you know, people are still being misrepresented. So video games, I think a lot of, I think there's some attitude of video games as being like the bastion of colonized thought, or a bastion of colonized thought that's going to be hard to break into. And this conversation is still very new. I think that that's something to contextualize for people, is that this is, you know, the video game conversation itself in society is still very new.
Yeah.
It's 50 years old. It's not going away, but it hasn't been fleshed out fully either. I think that's something people ought to remember. I guess if you want to share us some final thoughts about where you think Native American representation in media in general is going, as well as kind of like the self-determination factor, do you think where you would like to see things go for your personal preference?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, some of my more recent favorite indigenous games are really in that kind of complicated space that I just mentioned. You know, one game I really like and like to play and share with a lot of people is Spirits of Spring. I don't know if you've played this game.
I haven't yet.
It's a mobile game put out by Minority Media, and had a Minority Media really is interested in making what they call empathy games, right? And we might think about them as social impact games designed to shape perspective and behavior. This particular game is a mobile touch interface game, and it's designed with Cree art. So you'll immediately know that, right? If you know Cree art styles, you'll pick up the game and see that the world is sort of shaped by that art. And the story, on the other hand, is really something that I think your mainstream audience would immediately identify as indigenous, which means that indigenous audiences will see it as a kind of watered-down indigenous story. And you'll see that if you play the game, right? There's like a shamanistic narrative voice that tells this ancient story. And as you see your protagonist, Chewatin, move through this world, and by the way, with some really interesting gameplay, right? Some really unique gameplay. On the other hand, right, he meets animal helpers along the way. There are a lot of elements that I think feel extremely formulaic, and not just within video games. But what I like about this is that it's a game that is attempting to push forward on multiple fronts. And ultimately what that comes down to is a game design, company that wanted to bring on an indigenous game designer, and they did it. Not necessarily in the context of creating an entirely indigenous game development company, but one that involved indigenous designers, right? And I think that's really important moving forward for just more nuanced representations that can still reach broader audiences, that have gameplay that is intuitive, but at the same time is really pushing the limits of what it means to think about gameplay and game mechanics from an indigenous perspective. So the other game that really sticks out of my mind that I really love is Arrival, Village Cacique. I don't know if you've played that game.
I haven't.
And, you know, that game in a lot of ways is it's a historical game about the Taino people. It's a strategy game, so in many ways it's very conventional. But one thing I really, really enjoy about this game is that the mechanics of how you farm and produce resources in this game are completely unique. Right, it operates on a completely unique mechanism. And when I play it against Farmville, I see the ways that, you know, Arrival doesn't immediately commodify the food.
Right.
Right. When you're growing food, it operates on a kind of integrated polyculture farming technique that is completely unique from any other game in which you produce food resources, right, which it's, you're kind of operating on a monoculture sort of farming system. So those are these are the kind of interventions that I see, right? Arrival still is a historical game that, you know, represents the Taino in some pretty limited ways. The story is pretty limited. Right. And I think that there can be made some inroads can be made in that area. But it's these little moves forward, right? These baby steps in gameplay and really exploring what can be done in a way that's still intuitive for audiences. So that's really what I get excited about, are these kind of baby steps, so to speak.
It's interesting, you know, I'm sure I feel this way, so I'm sure you feel this way as well. You know, the progression we've seen in video games as a form is just insane. In the last 5 years, even, it is ridiculous. So I think it's so prudent for natives to just kind of jump onto those progressions, because even though they're small, they're going to go farther. You know, if natives had gotten into video games 10 years ago, I'd love to see where we've been.
And I think it's worth thinking about the ways in which indigenous game designers can positively impact the industry.
Right.
When I think about where half of the industry has gone, these are some really not cool places. I mean, the levels to which microtransaction has just infected video game, not just the industry, because I understand it from that perspective, but the way microtransaction has negatively impacted video game mechanics and design, and really I think is doing some unhealthy things to those who play games and enjoy games. And I think an indigenous perspective and indigenous designers working within that world can really push back against some of those really unfortunate influences. So
definitely. Well, thank you, Dr. Miner, for being on. I wish we had a little more time to talk, but this is great. Thank you for being on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Living Indigenous Media. Thank you.
Well, listeners, there it is, the interview with Dr. Joshua Miner. It was great having him on. I really appreciate his perspective on this new wave of Indigenous video gaming. It'll be really interesting to see where that movement goes. I'd love to have some more video game enthusiasts who are Indigenous, perhaps some video game creators would be interested in being on the podcast and maybe, have congruent or kind of intersecting opinions on some of these things we discussed. I'd love to hear your feedback as well. Join in on the conversation. Send me an email, comment wherever you're finding this posted. Again, thank you guys so much for listening. This has been Living Indigenous Media.